Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains August 8th through the 14th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm your host this evening, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the 14th round of the 2025 Formula One season, the Hungarian Grand Prix. To do this, I'm joined by Timo Albers Daly. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you, Mr. Billington. How about yourself?
I'm doing very well, actually. It's been a fairly busy Monday, and I've been sort of writing out my notes, pondering on things from the weekend, and I have some interesting thoughts, which I'm sure we'll get to. About how about yourself?
Yeah, a little bit the same. We were talking just before we hit record that there is plenty to talk about in terms of the first half of the season as a whole, but as a Hungarian Grand Prix in isolation, considerably less so, and it's going to be difficult at points to not stray off the path as such, because I think elements of why there isn't too much to talk about from Hungary in some respects is because of the overall season that we're having, the overall regulations that we're having, these elements that will come in a perhaps inevitable mid-season review. But in terms of Hungary, it was a pretty straightforward affair. And I don't know about you, but I don't mind we have a break now until Zandvoort. And I'm kind of, and this is a very backhanded compliment to Zandvoort, I will admit, glad that we have Zandvoort up next, because it's not going to take too much brain power to check back in for that and can just kind of check in, check out after that weekend is done, and then hopefully get things going again when we head to Monza. It feels like it's time for a summer break, and I'm not going to miss everyone as much as I perhaps normally would, which is a not nice thing to say, but we're just trying to be honest with our feelings. Or at least I don't know if you might have completely different opinions.
No, I think Zandvoort gives us a nice build up towards Monza. I think it works as a good preamble, and it's a very different circuit and often sort of gives some unique results or results that we don't necessarily anticipate, certainly a bit further down the field where things often get scrappy, which, given we've seen that a lot already this season, Zandvoort looks set to be sort of a good way to remind us of exactly what the crack is for the season. But we'll get to Zandvoort in about 3 weeks' time. We're here to talk about the Hungarian Grand Prix. We'll kick off with a bit of news, as important news is that Max has confirmed he'll be staying at Red Bull for 2026 at least. Enough said, really. It was a straightforward press conference going into the weekend that clarified his position and aims, and he gave it literally the morning after I'd recorded the preview with Haschap. So, yeah, as usual, skewered there.
As is tradition.
Yeah, the same with Fred Vasseur's contract as well. He's been renewed at Ferrari for a further 3 years, and it's odd that we don't usually hear about team principals getting sort of contracts extended. We heard a bit about James Vowles being continued on at Williams, but with Ferrari they made a big song and dance of this, and I think it's because they want to show that there is this stability, there is this backing, that Fred has been very vocal about backing both drivers and trying to develop the team. So I think that there's been a bit of a push for sort of everyone to go, wow, that's good, Ferrari are trying to make steps in the right direction, only for us to then immediately break Lewis Hamilton. After qualifying, he said, I'm just absolutely useless, which is not something we've ever really heard from him. We know he beats himself up a bit when he doesn't get the results he anticipates, but this was something else. But a lot more on Ferrari when we get to the team rundown. The other important bit of news is that the FIA have updated the Freck chassis. So this is if you're fans of... Is it still called Frecker? Is it still powered by Alpine?
Frecker.
Yeah, which is essentially the sort of European sort of feeder series that sits between Formula 3 and Formula 4. Their new Gen 2 car will improve safety and runs on Pirelli tyres. So it sort of fits nicely into that sort of mainstream line of feeder series that work their way up. And we look at some of the drivers that have appeared in F2 this season off the back of Frecker. There are some doing very nicely indeed. And the same with the drivers that have jumped into Formula 3 instead. Including, I want to say, Rafael Camara. I think he did Frecker before he came to F3.
Yes. And of course, fact for you on that front, he is the first driver since Oscar Piastri to win Frecker and F3 back-to-back. And the last time we saw a driver win a Formula 3 championship with a round to spare, it wasn't even called Formula 3 because it was GP3 and it was George Russell who did it, just to show you the kind of caliber of driver he is shaping up to be. And I just pray that he's not going down the Dennis Hauger route of absolutely trouncing an F3 field, moving to F2, and then being taken apart limb by limb and having to restart his career over in America and Indy next, which perfectly fine if that's what you want to do, but I just kind of hope that isn't where he's aiming for this. I'm intrigued with the upgraded car for Brecker, and I wonder how much F1 Academy drivers have come into play on that front. We've seen the F3 car has been redesigned this season to cater to all body types, but we have somewhat ironically not had the chance to see how that works. And F1 Academy drivers going into Freca have competed off the back of it, but haven't set the world alight. And there are a whole manner of theories as to why, but I wonder if one of them is potentially the chassis, the design, how it accommodates these sorts of things. And again, frustrating that we're going to have to wait until next season of Freca to see if we can find out how, if at all, that has changed. And it's good because it does help with that more clear and straightforward, if not easy, pathway to move up from one to the next to the next to the next. And in a way, then puts F1 Academy below F4, which is a curious notion at the best of times that we've had, but at least there is that bigger picture being seen and presented now, I want to say, in terms of establishing that hierarchy. Because before, we just saw Marta Garcia, for example, get shuffled over to Freca for a season, and we thought that's a bit of a sideways step rather than an upward step. And if they're re-establishing that or making it clearer for us, then that's fine, as long as we know what's what. But it's, I think, the frustration that I have, and maybe you share, and I know other people would definitely share, is that it's stuff that should have been done already. It feels in the same way that F1 Academy was a great idea, but would it have come along if W Series hadn't folded? It's one of these what if sort of questions, but in spite of all of that, they've updated the chassis. That's good. And we keep that going, and hopefully at least we're getting something there on that front, and we're not still asking questions about it. A little bit like with the F3 car, a little bit like with the F2 car. It's frustrating that we've had to wait as long as we had, but at least we got there and we're not still banging our head against the window going, guys, come on.
Yeah, I think important to note that F1 Academy is an F4 spec series. It does run to F4 regulations. It's not like sub F4 or sort of notched around it.
No, but you know what I mean.
It is F4 grade. It just doesn't run the F4 title. But yeah, Freca is sort of like a half. If F4 to F3, you deem as a full step. Freca is sort of like that half step, just sort of a bridging gap, which is odd because the step from F4 to F3 isn't that big. The step from F3 to F2 is a bit bigger. The step from F2 to F1 is huge. But for some reason, we've still got this sort of compression of all the ranks at the lower end of it. And then these sort of huge gulfs that start appearing between sort of the spec and class of cars. And I think that's where potentially sort of in his early days joining Formula One, we saw some great things from Liam Lawson because he was fresh off the back of competing in Super Formula, which in itself, its power, the way the cars are built and set up, sort of technically and mechanically
Not
sits.
kind of Formula 1.5, but it's not. But it's the most in between the two, you could maybe
It's in the
argue.
gap between Formula 2 and Formula 1. Admittedly, it's a huge gap, so it could sit anywhere, but it is a progression forward Super Formula in that sense. And Super Formula is also a league that you ascend to, and it is the top of essentially its league. It is the best single foot seater sort of racing series over in that part of the world, and it is a brilliant series to follow. But yeah, anyway, the Freck chassis, new one coming, great news for that. And obviously, congratulations to Rafael Camara, who the pressure is off at Italia and Grand Prix in a couple of weeks' time, because of course, he is also a Ferrari Driver Academy driver. So he will be have a little bit of pressure on him there from obviously the management. But yeah, doesn't have to worry about that now. Meanwhile, moving into a bit of analysis from the Hungarian Grand Prix, and we'll start in team order as we always do with McLaren. Piastri qualified second, finished second. Norris qualified third, and would go on to take the win.
Yeah, it's somewhat of a redemption from McLaren from last year's, let's call it, a bit of a mess of a Grand Prix in terms of execution. And the result being that the championship has close down rights to what is it, 9 points now. And as frustrating as it was at points to watch, it was also, like I say, a little bit of what we wanted McLaren to do last year, but perhaps the pendulum swung a little bit too much in the opposite direction, and it's very Hungary specific in that way. And that was maybe reflected in Piastri's somewhat impatient move, I want to say, towards the end of the Grand Prix. He knew he was running out of time. He knew he had to make a move at some point. And maybe he should have followed Russell's post-Grand Prix advice and just T-boned Norris and made things more interesting. It was his turn after Canada, after all. But yeah, a very uncharacteristic error from him. So I would say that going into the summer break, the momentum with Norris, but coming out of the summer break, I'd say that the momentum will be with Piastri because he's angry. And admittedly, you can't often tell, but you could tell definitely in the cool down room before Lando and George arrived that he was not a happy bunny. And I kind of want to see what that translates to because we've not seen him drive angry and we don't know if that's a bad thing or not yet. And I'd be interested to explore that. And if 9 points is sort of the thing of because of how close they always are together on track, and because we've not seen them really properly fighting yet this season, we saw a little bit here, we saw a little bit in Austria, and that's about it in terms of actually fighting properly. We still have yet to have this Lewis and Nico Bahrain situation. We've yet to have any Max and Lewis situation or any Max and Charles from Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. None of this has sort of happened yet between just those two for more than a lap or two. And Zandvoort, if you mix the conditions up, it's not an easy place to overtake at the best times, never mind in these humongous cars, but that could be a another Canada situation or another occasion where going down into turn one, lap after lap after lap, you could see them keep switching back and forth, and that could be quite interesting to see there. But yeah, I think Lando will be happy with where he's at coming into the summer break, but I don't know if that might lead him into a false sense of security. I'm not saying that he's going to be that he's stupid enough to do that, but out of the two of them, I don't think he's going to be as focused as Oscar is because Oscar's going to go and have his Creed 2 moment and go out into the desert and have a whole montage of training where he's pulling trucks with his forehead and all this sort of thing and getting really amped for the second half of the season.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think on a more holistic point, looking at the team and the way they put together their race weekend was a very interesting one because I thought they'd learn a lot off the back of Spa. Norris pushing for that one stop, again being forced to do something to counter because he didn't have track position with that top bunch at that point in time. And this was the scenario we saw in Spa as he had to go counter to Piastri's strategy, but this time it paid off. And it was absolutely stonking racing from both drivers. Those final few laps where they were getting close to one another and really starting to joust, and the pace was just going through the roof. Which, considering how far Norris had gone, 39 laps on those hard tyres, was astonishing to still have the traction, still be able to sort of the grip to really see at home with that pace was phenomenal. I'd say ignoring that opening lap and losing a couple of places, possibly one of Norris's best races when it comes to a sort of proper technical side and his ability to put together an entire race, ignoring that, being able to sort of resurrect it and to fight technically, I think was far more interesting than potentially we've seen Norris drive before, which is an interesting thing to carry forwards.
It's the ironic thing that a mistake like that on the first lap would create the circumstances for one of his better races. And I think perfectly encapsulates what is very frustrating about Lando Norris, both on and off track, is that you look at Zandvoort last year, for example, you look at Hungary this year. He can do it. He can be clinical. He can be there. But he just doesn't do it all the time. And there's no obvious reason as to why not. Spa was another good example. While he didn't convert it and didn't make the strategy work, he was in the right headspace for it. He was able to keep that momentum going. It wasn't a Miami last year situation where he was quite benefiting the safety car or the circumstances given to him. He went out there and did it in Singapore last year, another one of his better victories. And you think, yeah, So what's stopping you the rest of the time? And it brings back the whole conversation about mindset, about preparation going into a weekend, how he bounces back after certain race results. We saw that slump very early on in the season. Kind of made Bottas 2.0 jokes of him, and it seemed very true at the time. So I think that's the difference between him and Piastri. Piastri, he's just so quickly able to turn around and use whatever has come his way and just create opportunities and fuel out of it and use that energy, whereas Lando, it takes him a bit longer. And it's going to be interesting to see how that develops for the rest of the season, because he's on a good momentum now going into the summer break, as I say, but...
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
For his sake, he won't want to accidentally find that he's gotten complacent with it and goes, well, I can do it, so I don't need to do as much now to keep it going. It's like, no, that's exactly the time that you double down, because next year is a watershed year, potentially. McLaren could have properly ballsed it up for all we know, and you might not get another shot ever.
Yeah, I think having that incredible management, it's a tool that he's clearly got in the bunker for taking that fight to Oscar through the rest of the season. It's going to be interesting how he deploys it. You've got to feel for Oscar, and you can see where his ambitions lie as well, demanding that his race was not against Leclerc. He knew that the McLaren pace was going out over that Ferrari. He said, my race is against Norris. And he was saying that on the radio. He was saying, look, I'm not pitting counter to Leclerc. I'm trying to pit and race Norris here. And you can see,
ironically, a very Ferrari-esque strategy from McLaren there of, let's not race against the person you're racing against, let's race against someone else. And people go, guys, no.
Yeah, let's race against the guy that's innately slower. No, let's race against the guy that's about on my pace and I should be able to beat.
I presume you watched it on Sky as well, by the way.
Yeah.
I did find it quite hilarious that they spent like a good 2 to 3 minutes of going down to end. And him saying about how it's going to take Piastri ages to come up behind Leclerc, and even then it's going to be difficult to get past because of all of this and da 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 da. And he comes, he just basically pulls up and drives right past him immediately. Yeah. And you go, you might not be as good at your job as you thought here, because that was the exact opposite of what you said that was going to be. And you're meant to know a thing or two.
Yeah, the battle forecast was like, oh, four laps still a battle. And it wasn't a battle, he just drove past him. Actually, one more point on McLaren. Obviously, this is their 200th win, their fourth one, two in a row. Also, there's an interesting post-race interview with Zak Brown as he hinted that Alex Dunn might be doing an IndyCar test.
Well, Tony Kanaan is apparently organising an oval test for a bunch of McLaren drivers across the spectrum. Obviously, they've got two spare now that the Formula E team's folded, and they might want to see who to put in there for next year in any capacity. So... he's not going to get to F1, so might as well see if he's any good in IndyCar.
No, if Dunn can sort of wrap up this season really nicely in Formula 2, he's not going to make it into F1 because all the seats look pretty solid. Like, they've got a good bunch of drivers in there. And even with the arrival of Andretti, I don't think they're going to be snapping up a rookie. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. But we mentioned, obviously, Leclerc's pace and the fact that Norris just blew past him. I've got a lot of detail actually into potentially where that pace went and why it went. Leclerc qualified on pole, surprised even himself with that one, which was magical, but would go on to finish fourth after Ferrari potentially being a bit Ferrari about things. Lewis Hamilton meanwhile qualified 12th and finished 12th.
Yeah, there's again a tale of two halves here. Is Leclerc is very much the technical car side of things. Strategy came into it, but it wasn't the sole factor for him losing not just the win, but a podium finish there. But as you've got the detail on, I'll let you tackle that in a minute with Lewis. It's his first race outside of the points this year. And I think it is more a case of it's just Lewis versus Lewis, which is the problem here. We know how much he demands of himself. And interestingly, Fred Vasseur was saying that he doesn't need to motivate him. It's just something that he's got within himself because he demands so much from everyone, but the person he demands the most from is himself. And Perhaps it's still part of the lingering overtures of having switched teams for the first time in 50 years, and it's just not quite come together for him the way he would have wanted. Interestingly, Lewis as well was saying that there's some not great things happening behind the scenes. Didn't elaborate in any detail on what that was, and many people would automatically go, maybe that's something to do with Ferrari back at the factory, with management, all of these sorts of things. But it could also be something personal that we just don't know about, and he's accidentally let the mask slip a little bit there and has hinted that, and everyone's just going to assume it's Ferrari related, and we don't know what's going on. The rest of Johnny's a very private person. And whatever it is, it's definitely impacting his head, and he should also be someone who goes away with some break, like Piastri goes to the desert, does his whole Rocky Creed training montage, and hopefully come back out better. But I think the silver lining he can take away from this is that he moved to Ferrari at the start of this year. Sainz moved to Williams, Yuki moved to Red Bull, and Hulk moved over to Sauber, and Ocon moved over to Haas, and everyone else that's new is a rookie. Of all of those, you'd arguably say that Hulk and Lewis are the best two that have made a go of things of switching teams so far, and obviously there's a big gulf between those two cars anyway. But even when Lewis is bad, if we're going to call this season bad for him, he's still scoring points in every single Grand Prix bar one. And you could argue that here it was that little wobble coming out of, what was it, turn 13 in qualifying, and then the little wobble coming into the final corner that screwed him on the time, because he was doing pretty well on that point in, what was it, Q2. And then just the fact that, you know, this is part of the hint for mid-season review, the cars are so bloody big with these regulations, the tracks are so small in comparison, and because of the aerodynamic nature of the cars and all these sorts of things, it's just difficult to overtake in most places. So even if you're Lewis Hamilton in a Ferrari, it's going to be a struggle. And I think if he can just get his head back up to where we know it to be, the rest of it will fall into place. We know the car is good. Charles proves that. We know that when they get their shit together, Ferrari can be quite good at this. They just need to be a bit more consistent with it and listen to their drivers a bit more and have a car that isn't completely rebuilt from scratch for no apparent reason at the start of a season after having a perfectly good car last year. So I think there it's just Lewis needs to just sort himself out. He just needs to have a reset, because I don't think there's anything catastrophically wrong across the board or in any isolated area. I think it's just in his head.
Yeah, the Lewis one, I'm worried about his headspace, certainly after seeing that qualifying where he was so despondent out in sort of the early rounds of it while his teammate put it on pole. It was just sort of, it's not what you expect. And I don't think this current trend of cars suits him. You've got to look at his performance drop off from 2022 when we swapped this new style of car. The bigger, heavier car with the ground effects, it doesn't have a balance point where he wants his cars to be, and there's no way you can adjust that using the front and rear wings, because so much of it's generated by the floor. The floor is just going to generate it wherever the floor does. You can't really move that because of the shape of the car. So I think, yeah, add into that a team dynamic that just isn't suiting him, and that element you can tell because of the way that Charles is able to communicate with the team and actually drive them to do things. Lewis is still, there is a hurdle to get over when communicating with Ferrari. We always joke about Ferrari being Ferrari.
There's been a hurdle to get over communication for the last 10 years at least.
It's a hurdle to get over. We've seen so many great drivers struggle to get over it. Alonso, Vettel, Sainz and Leclerc.
Even Raikkonen to an extent, and he was the master of communication. So,
or not communicating and making it work. But if you look at the way that Sainz and Leclerc were able to make it work, they possibly found the knack to it. But yeah, Charles came in Q3, told the team exactly what they needed to do to capitalize, which was making the most of an emptier track than everyone else. It wasn't about track evolution, it was about traffic. And yeah, it degraded a bit from there. Obviously, Leclerc started on pole, great pace on the mediums. And then obviously the setup seemed to change when he swapped the hards for his second stint. And this is the interesting thing. We remember that Ferrari got a double DSQ in China for plank wear. And
This is possibly what led to this interesting result in Hungary. A debrief from our team racing driver, Alex Brundle, suggests that Ferrari's chassis is innately too low. And when we get to bumpier tracks with high downforce settings, which China is, bear in mind, you end up with this sort of plank wear that could be huge on a car that isn't sort of riding at the right level. On the medium, Charles had the mechanical grip to keep ahead, but once swapped to hards, his pace fell away. And this was likely because Ferrari were having to run higher pressures to keep the car raised up enough to avoid wearing the plank by simply having simply more tire sidewall, simply stretching it out to increase the ride height. And higher pressures means less tire in contact with the road too. Add in Ferrari asking for lift and coast, plus dialing back the engine mode to clip top speed to avoid full downforce loading, reducing that grounding risk. The maths, the evidence, the data came out today as well, actually sort of proving this theory that Ferrari were trying to avoid running as much speed and as much downforce as possible, because otherwise it was going to wear away that plank and they were going to end up with another DSQ. And I think the really interesting sort of cap on this will be when we get to Monza and Mexico and seeing how bad the Ferrari performance is there, because obviously there you won't be running high downforce loads because it'll be generated naturally through the high wing speed and the different rake angles and the different air level. So we're going to see this interesting result in sort of Monza and Mexico where potentially the Ferrari is back on form, but just because it's not having to fight its own aerodynamics, its own ride height.
I will happily take a Hamilton win at Monza if that's the case.
Do you want to write that in the predictions now?
I mean, I've been wanting it badly all my life. It's not Silverstone, I'll take it at Monza. So, yeah, thank you.
But Ferrari obviously aren't.
And it kind of backs up the point that the problem they had last year as well, with some respect to the car, because Mexico was quite strong for them. Monza, I think, was quite strong for them as well, because what was it, signed for second there? It was only just off the win, I think, wasn't it? So, and again, Austin is going to be the one they're going to be looking at going,
Yeah,
you've had this before, both of you, different teams, but both of you've had this, don't you dare.
Austin, because of the way that it undulates and the fact that it rides over these crests, you get these dips where the car bottoms out. Spa, you can get away with it because it only does it once a lap and you're not doing a great many laps as you go through La Source. But Austin, because you've got a slightly higher lap count and you've got the fact that it undulates and it twists and it turns, and it is quite a bumpy track, actually, Austin. It's likely going to do that a bit more. So, yeah, Ferrari won't say what the issue is, so we're left to speculate. But Alex's theory checks out nicely, especially when you look at how easily Oscar caught and blew past Charles and how easily George caught him as well. By that point, he had no mechanical grip. He wasn't able to exit that final turn and get the power down, plus his speed in that final part of that start-finish straight would have been top-end limited. So that's where we saw those drivers just coming past him, because they had a speed advantage plus DRS, and then they're able to really tidy it up into the braking zone anyway. And then obviously this infuriates Charles. Once angry, his defense was messy. It earned him a 5-second penalty. That was going to come. The way Ferrari operates is beyond a joke at this point. When you've got two drivers pushing to perform at the level they are, and a car that's in conversation for second fastest in the field, but there's something that's so innately wrong with the setup that they just forgot to factor in, has left them sort of having to sort of bodge it every weekend to try and avoid getting a DSQ since China. And to come away from a weekend with a 4th and 12th, I think for Ferrari, isn't on. And there's a lot for them to figure out over summer break. Are they going to change that rear suspension setup? No, because that's too much to ask of a chassis you're getting rid of at the end of the year. But are they going to hopefully find a different way of working around this? We'll wait and see.
It looks like they watched Drive to Survive, and when there was the quote of, why don't you just fix your fucking car? They thought it was pointed at them, and then they just changed everything for no apparent reason, and are now in this mess. It like, wouldn't honestly surprise me if that was the case behind it, given what Ferrari are like. But yeah, I think, like I said, there's not, I almost wish there was one fundamental issue, because at least then you could just tackle it head on. But there's not. It's just a multitude of things. And they're all fairly easily solvable. But you've got to do all of them. And I think Lewis can see that, Charles can see that, and Fred can see that. But because of the inner workings of Ferrari, it's difficult even for them with all their power and all their influence. Charles with his longevity with the team, Fred with his decades and decades of experience, and Lewis being a 7-time world champion coming in going, I want an 8th and I want it in red, still isn't somehow enough to make it all happen. And that's maybe something they need to figure out. And I think we've been somewhat joked after Spa that Charles and Lewis need to go away together and concoct some kind of a plan as to how they're going to sort all of the insides of Ferrari out to make it work best for them. And I'm beginning to think that was probably quite a smart idea and not so much of a joke, actually, because it would probably benefit the pair of them quite tidily in the long term.
Yeah, I think that there's got to be some conversations within Ferrari at this point, because this isn't a normal way of doing things. But
no.
Meanwhile, if you want a team that's split with a front runner and someone struggling to find the pace, you've got Mercedes currently sat in third place in the Constructors' Championship. Russell qualified fourth, moved up to third by the end of the race. Meanwhile, Kimi Antonelli qualified 15th and made it up to the back end of the points, at least P10. But yeah, I think this is forming a bit of a norm for Mercedes now.
Yeah, Russell back to doing even more Russell things. We're not too surprised at that. Very nice job he did early on and just continues to do. And hope he gets that contract extension sooner rather than later, just because why wouldn't you? Antonelli, he's on a bit of a troubling run at the moment. Despite that, though, it was great that he got up to P10, because I think in these teams, when you're new to the team, to the sport, or to the car, or a combination of the above.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
We're not necessarily expecting the podiums and the wins. You know, everyone was hailing Antonelli as a wonder kid. New Max Verstappen, that sort of thing. And I have yet to see that kind of potential in him, but he's definitely better than I thought he was going to be. And we've also got to remember a little bit like Hadjar, who's also dropped off somewhat in the last few races. It's still his rookie season, and he's got quite a big task on his hands. So for him to still kind of, through strategy, through overtaking, all the rest of it, to get up to P10, I think it's quite good and a nice little confident booster for him heading into the summer break, considering the run of form he's had lately, which admittedly has been more qualifying than the races, because the races, I mean, you look, it's also wiped out by Hadjar, couldn't do much about that. Imola, the car kind of just tied on him. Not much you can do about these sorts of things. Austria, rookie error, but again, nothing that makes you go, oh, that was absolutely terrible from him in terms of performance. You know, it's just that could have happened to anyone in theory. So I'm still a little bit concerned, but not too concerned about Antonelli. So, and hopefully summer break sorts him out as well in terms of just take a beat. You don't need to be going off and winning a championship straight away. You might be viewed as like the next big thing, but that doesn't mean you can't have the 5 minutes to get up to speed. You are still a rookie. Take your time. Toto has not put all this time and energy into you just to ditch you after one season, unless Max just happens something becomes available. No choice, we'll think about it. But considering that's been and gone, probably not going to happen. I can't see him wanting to replace Antonelli with anyone else.
Yeah, Russell getting the most from the car is no surprise, given how used to driving around issues he is. Antonelli still struggling is a bit of a worry, because I think Mercedes are going to give him the time, but we've said it before, we'll say it again, and this is something that Martin Valori raised, is it's where's the coaching? Bottas is doing a few bits with him behind the scenes, but there needs to be a more structured program for your junior drivers that doesn't just get them into the seat. It needs to.
We said this last week or the week before. It was kind of, you put all this energy into getting him there. You've got to keep it going. You can't just go, well, that's enough. We've got him in. You can figure the rest out from here. It's like, no, keep going. You don't train for your whole life to be a NASA astronaut. You get into NASA and then they don't teach you anything and just expect you to be able to fly a rocket. It's going, well, no, there is probably some things I should know before you just strap me in and fire up the engines.
Yeah, it's baffling. And I hope Mercedes do something to figure it out and like start bringing Antonelli back onto form and giving him sort of the support, the time, the data that he needs to improve, because he's data driven. We know that the guy can recite any lap time from like his previous career, which is a mind-boggling thing to do. He operates off data, and if Mercedes aren't appropriately sharing this with him and giving him the chance to dissect it and process it and make something off of it, this is possibly where the shortfall is. And speaking of teams with shortfalls, one that spread across both sides of the garage this weekend, Red Bull. Verstappen qualified 8th, finished 9th, and Tsunoda qualified 16th with a pit lane start, would then start 17th.
No, no, finished 17th. He wished he started 17th after that one.
Yeah,
Verstappen's is a slightly easier one here, I think. I mean, he was obviously out of position, but was able to fight back through the field a bit with a two-stop strategy. Interesting overtake on Hamilton into turn 4. Classic sort of Max move of you either move or we crash sort of thing, and Hamilton decided to move because he's seen that one before and he doesn't need to be getting involved in that. I'm not quite sure why it had to be investigated after the Grand Prix, especially when Hamilton then just didn't turn up to the investigation anyway and nothing happened. You'd think with some of the penalties that they were able to give out during the Grand Prix for other things, they would have been able to just look at that and sort it out. I suppose you'd have the testimony from the drivers, but again, pretty evident what was happening, and it's not as if you don't have any reference footage for the pair of them. They've been around a little while and have plenty of data points on them. Yuki was up there in qualifying, I'll give him that, and there are slim margins in qualifying this year, but he wasn't there. Ultimately, these slim margins are more important than ever, and for an experienced driver like him, it's surprising to see him still get caught out by that. And he was the lowest qualifying Red Bull car by a country mile. The new PU for the Grand Prix was a good idea by Red Bull, and it was just curious that despite that, again, bizarre strategy, but it was bizarre that he wasn't able to make headway with it, even if only a little bit further. I know it's one of those tracks where, like I was saying earlier, difficult to do stuff, but then you counter that with the strategy. To only finish ahead of the Alpine drivers isn't really good enough. I've got a bit more to say on him, but you have got a couple of points, so let's go for you on that, because I don't think there's much to say on Max anyway.
No, I don't really have anything to say on Max. I think obviously the Red Bull has taken a design step in the wrong direction, and it's clear to see that every weekend we see Max go and is constantly complaining and struggling for grip. And I think that maybe there's been a step change somewhere that they haven't gone back on, or they think they can design their way out of. The car doesn't have traction. If Max Verstappen, who famously can find traction anywhere, is struggling for grip, bear in mind that now that both cars have been put onto equal footing, this isn't going to be easy for Tsunoda. Before we criticise him for failing to make it out of Q1, it is worth taking note of that one-lap pace. Verstappen eventually would set a 1:15.547 with less traffic on an evolved track in Q3, but his Q1 lap time was 1:15.736. Yuki's Q1 pace was 1:15.899. We're talking 163 thousandths, 1.6 tenths off, which is not a big margin at all when we're considering how the speed of this. And Yuki was up there this weekend, but again, we're dealing with this huge compression of the field and the fact that all of a sudden Aston Martin, who otherwise would have been behind, had all of a sudden found pace this weekend. That's another two cars that would have gotten in the way. We've got the Saubers that are now up there regularly. I think the only real outlier to this was Ollie Bearman that was really up there as well. I think you could say he was fortunate that Ocon didn't get a good run in, and therefore wasn't also in the way, because this could have been an even harder hurdle for you to get over in a car that is an absolute pig. And everyone, even on the main broadcast, has now started asking the question, when are we going to see sort of Max swapped into one of the RBs, the Toro Rossos, because it looks to be the ultimately quicker car. And again, I don't think you can take finishing order or final results off of a session to be the be-all and end-all here, because there is a greater story at this. And Verstappen's pace was gone in the race as well. He was really struggling to get anywhere until he had a fresh set of tyres, could make some moves, and then ran out of tyre pretty quickly because the car was sliding all over the place. It grained up the face of the tyre. If that's happening to Max Verstappen, a four-time back-to-back world champion and arguably one of the greatest drivers we've seen for a generation, there's no way that, and I say this with love, Yuki, a mid-rate driver is going to stand any chance at doing anything with that. And you can swap as many drivers as you want into that seat as until you sit, basically find a way of cloning Max Verstappen and putting him in there, or put in a Lewis Hamilton, a Charles Leclerc, or a George Russell, or a Lando Norris, or an Oscar Piastri. You're not going to get those results. You can't keep criticizing one driver because they are not Max Verstappen. And this is where the whole sort of toxic example of the Red Bull seat comes from. Yes, it's easy to deride them, but we look back and think, oh yeah, we were comparing them to a guy that would go on to become and was at the time a four-time world champion. We do the same with Valtteri Bottas, who is ultimately probably quite a quick driver, but we put him up against Lewis Hamilton in his absolute prime. You're going to look second rate.
I do also have the argument with Bottas, if you put him in a much worse car in the Sauber, and he wasn't able to do anything with that. Whereas on the flip side, you stick Fernando Alonso in a terrible car like McLaren Honda, and he's able to drag that some of the time up to the point. Same with Jenson Button. It does show the difference between a good driver and a great driver. And I'm not saying...
That's my point. There is a difference between a good driver and a great driver, unless you have a team with two great drivers in it, with the exception of Ferrari at the moment, because something weird's going on there. You're going to struggle to get both cars competing at the same level. And that's what we've got to remember with Yuki Tsunoda. He is a good driver. He's earned his way into Formula One. He's proven he's got the pace. But compared to Max Verstappen, you're never going to be the golden child. Results-wise.
I don't think I've ever really compared him with Max Verstappen, because he's obviously not of the same caliber and is never going to be. But it's quite interesting seeing how he fares up against all of the people who have been in that seat for him, especially in their first seasons in the team. And admittedly, you have a Red Bull that does vary quite a bit from generation to generation, but it's just quite interesting to see how big a step back Red Bull have made when you take that big picture into things for this year. Because Yuki is the fourth most experienced second driver to ever be in that seat after Perez, usually Coulthard and Webber. But despite that, he's in this current era, and by this current era, I say from 2010 onward when we had this point system, he is the worst driver that they've had since Gasly in there, if you look at points before the summer break. And it brings this really interesting debate on how they operate as a team, what is worth demoting, what is worth promoting, because Gasly, as I say, was the worst driver up until now in that second seat in 2019. He got 28 points. Yuki's got, 10. And his 28 points was enough for him to get demoted after the summer break and replaced by Alex Albon, which is mind-boggling when you think about it now, and you go, well, surely then this would be the moment you'd swap it back. But again, you have the owner. What are you expecting that other driver to then do in that seat? But then that just takes me back to the start of the season. Goes, you should have just left Lawson in there, because you'd have probably just had, if nothing else, the same result. And you look at how Lawson and Yuki have fared over this first part of the season, and it is quite fascinating stuff. In qualifying, it's 7-all across, and it's 2-0 when Tsunoda was in Racing Bulls and Lawson's Red Bull, but then 7-5 to Lawson when they got switched around, which then balances out. And amusingly, it's the same with the Grand Prix. It's 7 apiece. It was 1-all when they were in their first two races in the season, and then it's 6-all the rest of the time. The crucial thing there is that when Lawson's been finishing ahead of Yuki, it's been in much higher positions in the points that he's been scoring. And that is why he's years ahead of him in the standings at the moment. And it just makes the wider situation all that more frustrating, I think, because you then go, well, what do we do with our second seat? And I do think at this point that the important caveat to put on that is that Lawson is essentially a rookie. Yuki is in his fifth season. And again, difficult car, fine. Tight grid, fine. But just only finish ahead of the Alpines, one of which had a 10-second time penalty to help that out, is still not good enough. I still think that you at least need to be between 15th and 10th, maybe, which he's doing some of, but nowhere near enough. He's on an absolute... He hasn't scored points since, I think, Miami. I mean, he had the sprint race points in Spa, but if we go for proper Grand Prix points, I don't think he scored since, like, Miami or Imola. And that is kind of insane. And when you look at historically on the points front, you've got to go back to 2006 to find someone who, without getting on the podium in the first half of the season, which is bad in itself because you could get less points than you currently has, but still be on the podium because of how points are allocated then. You've got to go back to Christian Klein to find someone who did worse than Yuki did in that second seat. And cute for a full circle moment for Red Bull, but probably not the one that they were going for ultimately. And I think now the best thing that they can do for their future is go, right, these racing bulls are brilliant in comparison and are really good at getting these drivers up to speed in terms of Formula One. Whoever finishes ahead of the three of them at the end of the season, arguably we should then put into that second seat. Agile, while he's not been in the Red Bull yet, would have had to have been living under a rock the rest of the time to not notice what has been going on over there. So whoever you then put in, you've got to do what Mercedes have done with Antonelli up until F1. And you put them in as many different Red Bull cars as possible from yesteryear. You put them in the sim as much. You give them everything. Because I think that's where it's still lacking with Yuki is that we, and maybe this is happening, mind you, but we just don't see or hear about it, is that there isn't enough being done to help coach the drivers along. If you've got a difficult car, how do you learn to drive around it? If you can't drive around it, what can we do with strategy? You know, there is a solution to it, but they just don't seem to be implementing any of it. And it's catching him out. And I think it's probably easier to teach a new driver, i.e. Lawson or Hadjar, how to do all of this, especially with a brand new car with brand new regs next year, than it will be a seasoned, I hesitate to call him veteran, but a seasoned driver at this point in Yuki. And for him to be on track for his worst ever season in Formula One just as he gets to the top team after all of his talk at the start of the season is kind of the ultimate oopsie-daisy.
I mean, you've got to factor in the slip back of that.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
That car, Verstappen has admitted that he does not think he will be winning or possibly even getting on the podium for the rest of this season, and that's Verstappen.
Yeah, but he said that at the start of the season as well in regards to when he wins Japan, so...
Yeah, admittedly...
I don't quite buy him not being able to do that. No one's going to be surprised if he does that, though.
He won Japan, Imola, and the Belgian sprint, but beyond that, Verstappen has been having an absolutely torrid season, but Tsunoda hasn't had points since Imola. That was a 10th place. After that, it was a 17th in Monaco, a 13th in Spain, an 11th in Canada, a 16th in Austria, 15th at Silverstone, 11th in the sprint at Spa, 13th in the Grand Prix at Spa, and then 17th here in Hungary. He's just not had a good season, but you could put anyone in that seat. So it doesn't matter who the driver is. It's faceless at this point. You put any driver that isn't top in that seat, and those are results you're getting week in after week out. You put Lawson in, you put Hadjar in. I reckon you even put Danny Ric in there. I don't think you're getting a great deal more points finishes. I think if you put Danny Ric in, you might score a 10th here or there a bit more, but that's it. And that's
more than we're getting
statistically. I reckon.
Yeah, I still think that in the grand scheme of things, he's not. Yeah, he. Yeah, I don't. I think he's cooked.
He's not
by the end of the season.
He's cooked at the end of the season, but not for any fault of his own. He is. I don't. This is because Tsunoda hasn't been trying. I think the problem is.
No, I don't. I just think it's not. I think the nail in the coffin for him as such, or at least the first one, is just the amount of F1 experience he does have. And the fact that you could stick a rookie in that seat and you'd be doing the same results properly doesn't help him. Because, yeah, it shows that how bad the car is, but it also shows where his limitations as a driver potentially are.
But also, the counter-argument to it is of... In those seasons leading up to this, it's not like the RB has been an exactly like a shining specimen of a Formula One car. It's had its moments for certain. I think he wouldn't have been in the Toro Rosso when the AlphaTauri when Gasly won at Monza. So he's not around for any moments of good in either car. He's been absolutely shafted for all the time, this car being atrocious. And the one time he gets a good result,
is the 2021 Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, where nothing really goes the way anyone anticipates.
I will just say to that, though, the counter to your counter is, look at all the wacky Grand Prix we've had during his time in Formula One, where teams like Alpine, teams like Sauber, teams like Aston Martin at points have been able to take full advantage of a crazy race, either due to chaos, rain, or whatever, and have been able to, if not get on the podium, get firmly inside that top 10. You look at Australia as what we thought was going to be Sauber's only point scoring result of the year. You go, fair play, you were able to sort that out, or, you know, these sorts of things. And the fact that he's not been able to do any of that either, he's the only driver on the grid, without the exception of the rookies, bar Antonelli, who hasn't even got on the podium. And I think the fifth season to not have achieved that, with the opportunity for almost crazy races at the very least, I think you can't blame the car on that for all of it.
But when you look at the drivers that did capitalize on those crazy races, you look at Ocon, who had Alonso act as a rear gunner for pretty much the entirety of a Grand Prix, holding off two world champions behind him. You look at, say, Ocon also ending up on the podium at Monaco. It's Monaco. No one's getting past you anyway. You look at Gasly getting onto the podium at Zandvoort. Once you've got up there, it's fine. It's track position dominated. You look at both of them getting on the podium in Brazil last year. It was a wet race. Everything was going to piss in a teapot. You look at the fact that the drivers that have achieved...
Yeah, and you've got to be able to take advantage of that situation, yeah, which they were. Why not just do that if you're...
That's partly also
whatever down, the team was called at that point.
That's partly down to the team and partly down to the driver. And the fact that the drivers that did achieve those things, Sebastian Vettel doing strange things to the Aston Martin, Alonso doing even better things to the Aston Martin the following season, those are very experienced drivers that are able to make a race that goes wrong come to them. That is not something that Yuki Tsunoda has had the chance to do, had the skill set to do, the ability to do, the opportunity to do, or the team support to do. Some of those things are on him. Some of those things are on the team. He's a driver that's just had the worst rub of luck ever and is unfortunately just going to sort of...
Would hardly go that far.
I think when you view it holistically, you look at what all the other drivers have been able to do and have done since and have sort of made marks on their career. They've had a podium, they've had a fastest lap, they've had a race win here or there. They've had these decent results. Yuki Tsunoda at the end of this year is ultimately going to walk away from his Formula One career and go, well, what did I achieve?
Square root of sod all, but I don't think you can put that squarely on the team or the car.
Or him.
No, but he's a big contributing factor to it in the same way that it shows what we go back to what we started this bit of the conversation with, is the difference between a good driver and a great driver, and questioning if he's actually that good to begin with, and should he have come up when he did. Questioned it at that point. I thought, yeah, if you're first or second in F2, fine, maybe anything lower than that, I don't know if you're ready yet.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's ever been quite ready.
We questioned that at the time, and I think reflectively, maybe we were right to question that. But at the end of the day, I think it's led us to this point where he just was going to be one of those drivers that just never makes anything out of Formula One, unfortunately. Hopefully, it turns around in the second half of the season. We've been talking about Red Bull, as usual, for about half an hour. So we'll move on to Williams, who are still in fifth place somehow. Carlos Sainz qualified 13th, would finish 14th. Alex Albon qualified 20th, finished 15th.
Second worst track on the calendar for them after Barcelona, and they had said as much coming into the weekend. So I'm not too surprised here at the results they got. They had some fun fighting for the lower end of the grid, but there was never really much that they were going to achieve here unless there was chaos up front, two drivers that aren't capable of taking advantage of that. So not too much for me to say there, unfortunately. I think Sainz is something to talk about in the summer break. He's had a much worse start to the season than I think anyone would have thought, whereas Albon has, despite his three DNFs in a row, had a much better time of things.
Yeah, it's hard to pick anything from the weekend for Williams, really. A bad setup and a rough qualifying meant it was always going to be an uphill battle for both of them. Some great moments from Carlos caught on camera, though, clearly still pushing and was definitely a bit more attuned to the chassis this time round. So I think there was a spark of something a bit more exciting happening. But yeah, I think for Williams, this is maybe they turned off development a little too early on this car. Maybe they should have had one more upgrade package coming later this year, just to give them a chance to be in the fight for fifth. But yeah, I think behind them, they're lucky that the battle for sixth seems to be constantly swapping.
Fifth is theirs to lose, and I don't think they're going to lose it, because with the circuits that we've got left and the drivers that are in those teams, or in that team rather, they're going to still pick up the odd thing here or there, and they are capable of doing what Alpine did in Brazil last year, for example, or what, again, weirdly, Alpine did in Zandvoort. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw one of them in the top five again or on the podium. And like you say, the battle on P6 behind it is very tight. And it's quite interesting, actually. I was looking at the points spread between Albon and Colo Pinto. And doing, let's face it, he's still in this. And if you got one of these three Grand Prix where you get Bottas balling, essentially, and you wipe out a significant portion of the field. So let's just say that a load of drivers don't score any points. Let's say this happened to Zandvoort as well. You could have someone like Lawson win a Grand Prix, and he'd be within like less than 10 points of Albon in the standings. He'd just rocket up. That's an entire season, like an entire half a season's worth of progress demolished by one race, and you then add that to someone a bit further up the order, like Alonso, and it changes things again massively on its head. And that's what they're kind of, that's how close the margins are. And it's quite interesting because you've got that gap then up to Antonelli, who's kind of in a no man's land by himself, who's probably safe in that area, barring too many kind of chaotic races in the second half of the season where the lower teams capitalize on it. But that battle for P6 in particular is going to be quite tasty because it's so nip and tuck at the best of times there.
I don't think Antonelli is that safe. He's only, checks notes, 10 points clear of Albon. And if Antonelli's going to have weekends where he's only scoring a point or two at a time, and Albon has a few more weekends where he can sort of knock in a 10-pointer, all of a sudden, he's passing that Mercedes seat and things get interesting again. The only other driver that really comes close after that is, oddly enough, Hülkenberg on 37 points, but he's a long way. Mm. But the battle for all the seats behind them is absolutely fascinating because, just scroll across.
Alonso and Stroll on equal points. You've got Lawson above Sainz and Bortoleto. Now Bortoleto is within strike. If Sainz hadn't scored points in the sprint last time out in Spa, Bortoleto would be ahead of him right now. Both of his seasons are going.
Ocon on 27 points. Then you've got Alonso and Stroll on 26 apiece. 22 is Hajar. And then after that, 20 for Lawson, 16 for Sainz, 14 for Bortoleto. It's so nip and tuck down in this sort of region that one good weekend will send you rocketing up the order. And we saw that for Bortoleto this weekend. He's gone from 19th up to 17th. The same for Alonso. He went from 15th to 11th. Like, that's how densely packed this arena is, that one decent result puts you that far up. And it only takes Ocon to get another mystical fifth, and all of a sudden he's overtaking one of the Mercedes drivers, and Williams again just edges its way a little bit further off of Aston Martin. When you look at the way they sit in the team standings, you've got actually not a huge, they're ahead of everyone else. They're on 70. They've got about 20 points clear. Aston Martin 52, Sauber 51, RB 45, Haas 35, Alpine 20. So they're clear, but again, Sauber, Aston Martin get another sort of decent double pointer, they're going to start closing in.
Aston Martin came out of nowhere this weekend. I mean, Alonso and Stroll having tremendous qualifying performances, qualifying fifth and sixth respectively. Not too surprised that Stroll dropped one place at the start essentially and finished in seventh in the end, but still for Stroll that's basically a win. And then Alonso manages to keep P5 just by buggering around as he does best and trying to ruin it as much as he can for everyone else, which, as Martin Brundle said on the commentary, why shouldn't he? And yes, why shouldn't he? He's now also the oldest active driver on the grid since Graham Hill, which is just insane. And all of this, bearing in mind, without being an FP1, because Drogovic sat in for him because of his back injury that he sustained in Spa. So he just sits out for, what was it, an hour and a bit, gets back in the car for FP2, and then goes, yeah, that'll do. Right, slaps it on P5, finishes in P5, walks away into the summer break, goes, that'll do me nicely.
We've seen that before. Was it British Grand Prix where we had Alex Dunn in the McLaren or something? Or we had Alex Dunn in one of the McLarens and then the driver immediately went on to like have an absolute stonker of a weekend. So perhaps that's the magic. You have to give your car up for FP1 to have a bit of magic dust sprinkled on it by an exuberant Formula 2
You're
driver.
listening to that Lewis get Bortoletto, sorry, get Kamara in that Ferrari in Zandvoort and watch it go for you then.
Yeah. Or do it at Monza after, Kamara's not.
Right, he'll be fine. He can take care of that himself, I reckon. He's got that one.
But yeah, it's a phenomenal performance out of nowhere, seemingly, for Aston Martin. Maybe the track conditions suited them. Maybe the weather was right for them. Maybe they brought the right floor this weekend because they didn't bring the right one to Spa, which would probably explain why they were so far off the pace. A new front wing, I think, they had this weekend also really helped home their setup, and it showed points of both, and they've absolutely flown up the standings as a team and as individual drivers. So it's the battle goes on, and we'll jump straight into Sauber as well. Bortoletto qualified 7th, finished 6th. Hülkenberg qualified 19th, finished 13th. Not the best for Nico, but Bortoletto, for me, possibly going to be rookie of the season, because when you look at the consistency of his performance, the lack of mistakes, he's absolutely on the money. The growth we've seen, which is what you want to see from a rookie, is growth. It's clean, it's consistent, and he held off Verstappen at points and was making a few moves, dicing around with other people in the field at that top end in a Sauber. This is exciting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it helped me when Verstappen was looking at Bortoletto. It reminded me very much of him versus Mick at Silverstone a couple of years ago, going, what the hell is going on here? And then Mick as well at Austria with Lewis, and you're going, I wasn't expecting to see this today, but I'm here for it. It's going to be tricky choosing a rookie of the season because I think all of them have had quite good moments. Well, okay, nearly all of them have had quite good moments. I've just remembered Fangio Quattro exists. Lawson is coming into his own. Bortoletto coming into his own. Behrmann, I think his positioning in the championship is at least reflective of how his season's going because he's so near the money every single time that should something happen, he's there. And some of the time, he's been there, like a sprint. He's been able to take advantage of the opportunities. And Antonelli, I think I'm probably happier with him than other people are because I just didn't rate him that highly for the season anyway. So for him to have come in and done what he's done, I've been quite happy with him. It's going to be tricky to choose, but Bortoletto is definitely up there and a great weekend for people who used to drive for Trident.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains August 8th through the 14th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Or are currently driving for Triton in F3. It's quite good stuff, and I love that Bortoletto was there with a very solid race. And it's just so weird to think that at the start of the season, you could have told us that Hulk and him and the team would be in this position. We'd have gone, yeah, you're having a laugh. And yet they're here pretty much on merit. And yeah, it's a shame that Hulkenberg couldn't get a decent qualifying run, but then also getting to the points. But the fact that we're saying that is madness in itself. And this is the kind of thing I wanted from Yuki, for example. You know, you qualify badly, but okay, yeah, you missed out on points, but at least there's progress, there's measurable progress. And that was done through one way or another here. And P13, yeah, it's a shame, but at least it was moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I think there was progress up the grid for Nico. And it's Hungaroring is such a track specific setup or track position specific setup. You've really got to get a good stab at your qualifying to really have a good chance. But yeah, he had a good run at it, and his recovery was strong. I think as a team, they can go into the summer break with their heads held high off of the first half, showing great growth. We'll move to two more rookies, Racing Bulls. And Lawson qualified 9th, finished 8th. Hajar qualified 10th, finished 11th, just outside the points. Both cars outpacing the big boys this weekend. Solid one. Isaac having to fight for his life, really, to hold on to that top 10 spot. But in the end, it's such a close battling midfield. It just sort of... He,
claimed to the finish. It's a good performance, though, but nothing astonishing. I think we're going to get an incredible weekend for the Racing Bulls at some point. Maybe something like Zandvoort's going to chuck up a weird one for them. But yeah, I think it's coming this season. There's going to be something that's absolutely a bit of a bonza for them. But yeah, this was a good one showing they've got the regularity to deal with it.
Yeah, Hadjar, a little bit like Antonelli, has been having such a tremendous season so far that we then start criticising him for coming 11th. And you go, oh yeah, he's a rookie in a Racing Bull. Never mind, I take it all back. And Lawson be the highest finishing Red Bull driver. Talk about getting Bichat to imitate Clarkson with his smug face. That is the opportunity you get to do that. He got past Verstappen at the start. Then he got strategically past him later on. And he's now got double the points of the driver that replaced him at the top team. He's on equal points with Gasly. He's 2 away from Hadjar and only 7 away from Ocon in P10. Reinforcing how close we were saying that championship battle is. So he's going to be absolutely laughing there. Close for Hadjar, but no cigar. But I think his qualifying record will make him happy because he is just solidly putting in those performances, and he's not been knocked out in Q1 yet at all this season, which is an accolade only he owns, which is, again, not a prediction we would have made at the start of the season. And if I'm to get my points for season prediction, he's going to have a terrible second half of the season because he's going to be smashing up his car left, right and centre, because we thought that was how his season was going to go. So how wrong I definitely was, and how wrong definitely a lot of other people were, I think, who were thinking along similar lines.
Yeah, I didn't have high expectations for Hadjar coming into this season. I think we both predicted him as potentially having like the biggest damage bill and a few other bits. Like the growth he had between Formula 2 and coming into Formula 1 was huge. Like we've seen a completely different driver arrive than the one that left Formula 2 rage screaming down the microphone when he backed it into the wall at Monza. It's incredible. And it's what you want to see is this growth, this development in drivers. I think Racing Bull's nurturing that really nicely. Haas, meanwhile, Behrmann qualified 11th. Clearly, the boy has some sort of fascination with the number 11. Would unfortunately go on to DNF, rear-end problems. Meanwhile, Ocon qualified 18th, moved up to 16th by the race's end. Sort of woeful, really, off the high of Spa, where they picked up some points in the sprint. You can only come to the conclusion they just hadn't nailed down their setups going into each weekend, and it's just guesswork for Haas a bit at the moment, it seems.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a rollercoaster season for them. They either get it or they don't. And I think this was just one of those tracks where they didn't, unfortunately. I'm not too worried about them as an outfit, though. I think, like I say, Ocon has been surprisingly competent in that Haas, again, going off the expectations I had when his move there was announced and what we thought prior to the season, and Behrmann as well. Like I say, it's not a DNF that was his fault. And he's pushing the car in the places he needs to put them in should anything happen, being short of the pace at certain tracks where it's going to go well for them to do it. And as we said, this isn't going to be one of the tracks where they were going to, but should something happen out front of me, we were less than a metre away from having a Russell Leclerc Alonso podium. If we'd had that and Behrmann could have kept going, would have seen him firmly in the points. So, you know, it's these kind of things that make me go, you know what, I'm not too worried about you lot.
Yeah, not too worried about Behrmann, I think, as well, because the retirement wasn't something he had caused. It was rear-end damage. I think someone maybe sort of tapped off a couple of diffuser plates with their nose cone, and as a result, he was losing rear-end grip. He was losing sort of stability. And ultimately, in a cost cap era, you're going to retire your guy if you're not certain you're going to get points and you're starting to slip backwards down the field. Better to retire him than bend it and ruin the chassis and have to get another one out of the box. So sensible play, but I think their performance up to that point had looked fairly stable. I think Behrmann looking very strong. Final team on the roster, Alpine. Gasly qualified 7th, finished 19th. Meanwhile, Colapinto qualified 14th, finished 18th. I don't say this often, but credit to Colapinto for absolutely ankle-snatching Pierre Gasly as Sainz pulled off that wicked dive bomb move. Saw the gap, went for it, earned nothing for it, but does mean he finished ahead of his teammate, so not the worst.
Admittedly helped by the fact that Gasly did get a 10-second time penalty.
Yeah, so, but he's done on track.
Say again? Yeah, but I still think he was ahead of him over the finish line, was he not?
No.
No? And I'm just used to Colapinto into being terrible, so that's made no difference anyway. I didn't think that much shows how well a race that was anyway. Yeah, I think despite somehow a slightly good race for Colapinto, it somehow still results in second worst result of the season so far. So, yeah, kind of a backhanded compliment in some ways. Like, you did fine, but you're still pretty awful.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain that Gasly finished ahead of. Might be able to find the full classification, final race classification. Here we go. The full classification of it, because I'm fairly certain that Gasly finished behind Colapinto once you allow for that. Oh, no, he might have been let back through. Interval to the driver ahead, he was 2 seconds ahead of Colapinto, so he must have gotten back past. But there was a great moment of opportunity for Colapinto, then I stand corrected. But there we go.
It didn't work. It kind of makes it even worse than Colapinto, then, because not only was it worth nothing, but then he still got back past.
Yeah, still
so then had to rely on a penalty.
I retract my statement entirely. Oh, well, winners and spinners. Timo, your winner.
Liam Lawson, just because it was the humble pie he's getting to eat of being the best Red Bull driver there this weekend. And it would be rude not to make a special mention of Aston Martin as well, because he might not get to do that again this year. I mean, they were your spinners last week, I think. And yeah, what a difference a week makes. I've been saying that a lot over on the Curbs IndyCar this year, but didn't expect that to say about Aston Martin and F1. So it's nice to have something different.
Yeah, truly a case of what a difference a week does make. Indeed. My winner, I'm going to go for Gabriel Bortoletto. Had some great battles with experienced drivers and came away looking incredibly well-rounded as a unit. And I think if that Sauber sort of can reach a good peak of development and then start to focus on next year, we could be in for something very interesting indeed. I'm looking forward to seeing sort of Gabriel glory, hopefully at some point down the line. But P6 in your rookie season is pretty good indeed. It took a fair few other drivers in backmarker teams to take a lot longer to do that. Meanwhile, spinners, Timo.
Just because it's not Williams' fault entirely, and you've chosen the only other viable option. I think everyone else did, I think as a team, didn't do as terribly.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I think for me, Ferrari, absolute spinners off this one. They're going to throw away more than just the odd podium here and there at this rate. There is going to possibly be a slip in constructor standings if they keep up this rate of just not doing what seems to need to be done. And the only thing I can think of there is there's some sort of master plan at work, but I even then, as the most Ferrari optimist ever, or optimistic Ferrari fan, I can't see it coming true. Meanwhile, when it comes to predictions, neither of us saw that pole position coming. Neither of us saw Lando Norris getting the win either. However, I predicted Oscar Piastri to come home second place. So I get a point for that. And we both get points of fastest lap, where we both predicted George Russell to achieve that one. And
forgot we did that.
Yeah, and I got a further point for predicting Alonso top five. Genuinely not sure what inspired me to put that one down. But
I think what's happened here is you've also brought the right floor for this weekend, and you've just done what is only going to happen this weekend for Aston Martin. You've had your good race now.
Yeah.
Unfortunate that it's at the midpoint of the season.
Yeah, it does mean that overall, now we've got to the midpoint of the season, we might as well rattle off how things look. Timo still leads on 17 points. I'm closing up to him now on 13 points. Ellie May.
Oh, you know what? I'm relieved now. I thought you were a lot closer.
I'm on 13. I'm still a little way off. Ellie May's on 7. And I'm closer to you than Ellie May is close to me. And then the guest is on 2. So we've got an interesting field spread as it stands, all still to play for. Ellie May losing her early lead, principally on the count of she just sort of hasn't been here for weeks on end.
She has access to the Google documents. She could does put have in stuff if she wanted to. So she can't blame us for this one. She's only got herself to blame.
She can come in and make her predictions. We write her name into the slot each week, but she never fills it out. Meanwhile, when it comes to Fantasy Formula One for Hungary, DTKS, 247 points takes the win. Big Reach 243. I think that's my girlfriend's team. And three 234 points in third. Catherine's Curse and On the Curbs in P4. On the Curbs IndyCar P8. The Mixing Pot P22. I did not have a good week.
Your highest team. This is the unfortunate bit. I certainly have to point out that whenever I do this, I do look for the highest teams, and some days. The good thing here is the next one is Ellie Mae's highest team. Which is good for you, bad for her.
Yeah, I got rid of in the Mixing Pot Lewis Hamilton, who scored precise. I don't know what points he did score this weekend because I got rid of him. I can't remember who I swapped in.
You put Leclerc in.
I think I might have done, yeah, which was great because that scored me at least some points. I used that final fix trick on Jaffa Cake Racing as well, getting rid of Esteban Ocon. Fair enough. I can't remember who I put in his place. I think I might have put in either Alonso or Stroll. So I earned points there.
Ballsy of you to put in Stroll if you did.
It was a ballsy move, but possibly what I could afford at that point in time. But yeah, that I could have done worse, I think is what I'm trying to say. Cat Dad's finished P28 and some smooth operators P63. Jesus, how bad a week did they have if they finished behind...
It is also his team.
Oh, it's also one of his teams.
Yes.
Oh, Christ. Let's go and have a look. Hang on. No. Don't do that one. Close. Go away. We need to go to Hungarian Grand Prix. The worst one in the field. Oh, yes. Who does he have in there? Oh, no. He's got all active drivers. But Albon and Behrmann and Haas lost him a lot of points. Somehow he scored positive with that. 33. Points. Somehow his Kiwi...
Miracles do happen.
Yeah, somehow his Kiwi Burners one did all right. Lawson, Gasly, Doohan, Lawson inactive, Doohan inactive, Bortoletto and Ocon. Saved, really, by Racing Bulls and Mercedes scoring 54 points. Baffling times for Robert Percy. Go and change your team. Meanwhile, overall... Dieter Klaas still leads 2,730 points. LeVictory, 2,610. And Lando, 2,591 points. Big Reach now in P4. Catherine's Curse, P5. On the Curves, P9. Can't Grow Moustache, P12. The Mixing Pot, P14. Red Bull Rejects, P62. And Kiwi Burners, however, still at the bottom of the pile on P63. That is all we have time for on the Undercut podcast this week. We'll be back in a few weeks for a preview of the Dutch Grand Prix. In the meantime, though, Timo, where can you be found?
Instagram for everything, pretty much. T.Albert.David on my curves for podcasts, for interview, written and video, and a bit of everything else in the meantime.
Very nice. And if you want more from me, you can find me writing for Classic Car Weekly and on the Classic Car Weekly podcast, as well as on the social medias at Jesse on Cars on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And of course, we will have a mid-season review, probably of Formula 1 and Formula 2 coming out. So keep your ears peeled for that indeed. Otherwise, we'll be back in about 3 and a bit weeks or so with a preview of the Dutch Grand Prix.